It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Will Kane.
I'm Dana Perino.
I'm Greg Jarrett, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, March 6th, 2024. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Super Tuesday is in the books. Near clean sweeps for President Biden and former President Trump as the likely general election matchup between the two moves closer to reality.
So this is a sea of Trump red across the political map from California to Texas to Virginia.
I'm Dave Anthony. The father of a school shooter is on trial this week in Michigan. The boy's mother's already been convicted for not doing enough to prevent their son from going on that killing spree.
Did they act appropriately? I don't think they did. I think that they were negligent as parents in what they did. But I'm still quite divided about using the criminal code for this purpose.
And I'm Tommy Lahren. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Super Tuesday saw former President Trump winning nearly every contest, including the delegate-rich states of California and Texas. But he did not win Vermont, which went for former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, giving her some delegates. President Biden won nearly all of his contests as well, except for American Samoa. Nikki Haley had no events on her calendar, no election night speech at a party headquarters. Fox's Bill Malusian has more.
We asked the campaign, what are their expectations heading into this Super Tuesday? They told us to be competitive. We asked, well, what does competitive mean? They said it's up for the media to decide that, but they point out that Nikki Haley's been getting chunks of voters in these early states. They feel there is an appetite for a non-Trump vote out there.
But earlier in the day, Nikki Haley told Fox and Friends,
this is not an anti-Trump movement. This is a pro-American movement.
What her next steps were, though, weren't immediately clear on election night. Former President Trump spoke from his estate, Mar-a-Lago, in Palm Beach, Florida.
They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one.
He gave a toned down, at times even somber speech.
We had the safest border, the best numbers we've ever had, and now we have the worst numbers probably in the history of the world. It's sad to see what's happening to our cities. Our cities are being overrun with migrant crime.
But his words focused on President Biden, the state of the country. He did not mention Nikki Haley.
It's been all but over on the Republican side, certainly since South Carolina, when Nikki Haley wasn't unable to really come close to winning her home state.
Josh Krausauer is Fox News Radio's political analyst.
And when you look at the Super Tuesday results, with the exception of Vermont, which is the one state that Haley has in her corner, but the rest of the map is overwhelmingly Trump territory. From Alabama, Trump won by a 70-point or so margin. North Carolina, 50-point margin. Even Virginia, which looked like it could be a state where Haley was at least competitive, she loses by about 30 points. So this is a sea of Trump red across the political map, from California to Texas to Virginia. Vermont, the one blip of Haley pink on the political primary map. But boy, this is a route for Donald Trump and a sign that he has a hold. A stronghold over the Republican Party. And frankly, a lot of these Haley voters, as I think is underscored by the Vermont result, the Washington D.C. result over the weekend, a lot of the Haley supporters are increasingly Democrats or liberal-leaning independents that have participated as crossover voters in these Republican primaries.
All right, we're also joined by my colleague, Fox News Radio Washington D.C. correspondent, Jared Halpern. Jared, you heard the speech with me. Former President Trump sounded serious, even a little bit maybe somber. He used the word sad a couple of times to describe like the state of the country. Just as someone who listens to a lot of political speeches, including campaign ones, what was your impression of his tone?
Well, it was a general election speech. He didn't mention Nikki Haley one time in the entire speech. He barely even mentioned Super Tuesday. He kind of began with it and ended with it, but the rest of the speech was kind of a condensed version of a lot of the stump speech that he gives, maybe a little bit less rah-rah to your point, a little bit more circumspect as he talked about immigration, as he talked about the economy. And he is setting up, I think, what his general election message is going to be, right? He talked about, you know, the job that his administration did, how, you know, what the economy looked like, what the world looked like. I think trying to remind voters maybe, you know, to think back about those times. And you're going to see that from President Biden as well, right? He is going to talk about the chaos, the uncertainty, the demagoguery, all of that he has talked about, that the importance of democratic institutions over the 4 years of the Trump administration. So listen, these are two campaigns that have very different visions of how the 4 years of the Trump presidency went. And you're going to see that now play out. Boy, for a long time, right? This is going to be one of the longest general elections we've had in a while.
It is so interesting because Trump's campaign has already been a lot of, remember what it was like 4 years ago. Like,
right.
It's not a typical campaign. Josh, what did you think of the tone and the vibe around how Trump sounded, how he came across?
Yeah, look, I mean, this was not New Hampshire. This was not him going after Nikki Haley, who he's already vanquished. He needs to focus on the general election. He's doing well, if you believe all the latest polls, in the general election against President Biden. I thought his focus on border security and immigration is a smart political move. You're going to be hearing a lot more of that, given that it's a top issue for voters heading into the general election. And look, this is a every time you say Trump is more disciplined, he always regresses and says something that is just outrageous and politically unwise, and we go back and forth for indefinitely. But it was the kind of speech that is looking ahead and focusing on his opponent for the general election.
And Jared, the White House response was, tonight's results leave the American people with a clear choice. Are we going to keep moving forward, or will we allow Donald Trump to drag us backwards into chaos, division, and darkness that defined his term in office? 4 years ago, I ran because of the existential threat Trump posed to the America we all believe in. Is this how the president goes after Trump's quote-unquote jugular, as Axios reported he was going to do heading into Super Tuesday?
It's how he has been going after his predecessor since the very beginning. Recall the very first event, the first political event that President Biden did earlier this year was outside of Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, right? And that was by design. That was a speech, I was there, that was entirely about the threat to democracy, how this is an election about bigger issues than just policy disputes, right? That even if you don't like everything from a policy standpoint that President Biden is doing, you need to vote over a much bigger issue, right? The democracy as we know it, these democratic institutions, that has been a constant theme of President Biden, even before the campaign had started in earnest. Remember, he gave that speech in Philadelphia that kind of hit on many of the same themes. Now, a lot of people were critical of that speech. It was a presidential address. It was not a campaign speech. But the themes are the same. And I think you're going to hear from President Biden a lot on that. And I think you're also going to see the president talk about the economy. And you have seen him lean into immigration and border enforcement. I expect Thursday night we probably see the president talk about the role, in his view, that former President Trump played in derailing that bipartisan immigration agreement that was emerging in the Senate, and kind of laying some of that blame on Republican shoulders as well. But the broader theme of democratic institutions and this existential threat that President Trump is to American democracy is not a new sentiment from President Biden, but it is one that I think Democrats think is a winning strategy, and one that I think you're going to see the president lean into a lot heavier over the next several months.
All right, Jared, quickly, is this going to be dueling discussions about the border from Republicans, abortion from Democrats, with the economy sort of sprinkled throughout the rest of the year, barring anything else happening in 8 months, which is a really long time?
No, I think both parties are going to try and win voters on those issues, right? I think you are already starting to see Republicans try and message the abortion issue. Certainly they know what role that played in the 2022 midterms. You're hearing them kind of talk about federal legislation that they argue is in line with where a majority of Americans are anyway on the abortion issue. On the border, you are seeing President Biden take a much different tact, right? He visited the border. He talked about this emerging deal that would have really toughened existing asylum laws and gone further than a lot of Democrats even were comfortable with. But he sees that this is an issue, and he's blaming Republicans and particularly Donald Trump for blowing that up. And so I think that you are starting to see some of the seeds from both Republicans and Democrats on how they can maybe be aggressive, play a little bit of offense on these two issues that they have really had to be back on their heels for the better part of a couple of election cycles now.
Okay, and finally, one more quickly for you, Josh. These uncommitted voters, double digits out of Minnesota, North Carolina, Massachusetts. Does President Biden have an issue on his hands that he needs to address, or are these voters who, you know, they're not going to go for Donald Trump, so he's not going to worry about them?
Yeah, look, you can look at where these votes are coming from. They're from the most left-wing elements of those states, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Minnesota, Durham, Chapel Hill, and North Carolina. I don't think Biden has a huge problem with you know, a lot of these are anti-Israel votes, by the way. These are, you know, communities that are filled with left-wing activists, similar to what we saw in Dearborn in Michigan and some of the college towns in Michigan. But it's a problem when you look at the bigger picture. Biden has a big problem with his progressive base. He is getting weak support from younger voters that should be overwhelmingly supporting a Democrat against Donald Trump. Weak support among African-American voters. Weak support among a lot of the progressives for a Democrat. So that is a big challenge. Biden's facing challenges on both sides of his coalition. He's got progressives and the base that are very lukewarm towards him, but he also is losing swing voters and moderates and the persuadable voters that backed him over Trump in 2020. So it's a no-win situation for Biden. You see some pockets of discontent among left-wing precincts, but he also, you know, if he pandered to the left, he would also lose more votes from the middle that he also is struggling with.
I was also going to say on those points, Josh, that if you look at the Republican side of that coin, and certainly it has been a dominant performance by former President Trump, but even in states like North Carolina, 23% or so go to Nikki Haley. There are states where she is up in that sort of 24-25% range. Are those votes that are winnable for former President Trump?
Well, look, a lot of these, it's striking when you look at Nikki Haley's strongest areas. There are parts of the country like Arlington, Virginia, heavily Democratic suburb of Washington, D.C. You've got Burlington, Vermont, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Some of these are open primary, not all of them, but a lot of these states have open primaries that we just talked. I'm not sure if these voters are going to vote Republican at all, no matter who. If Nikki Haley was the nominee, they might not even vote for her against Joe Biden, because a lot of Democrats have kind of voted in the Republican primary to cast a ballot against Donald Trump. Now, that may be about, you know, in Virginia, I think it's about 10% of the electorate were Democrats, maybe a little less in some of the other states and that have open primaries. So I don't even know if we're seeing Republican voters, even like anti-Trump Republican voters. Some of these are anti-Trump Democrats that voted in these primaries. And that's why, like, some of the bluest parts of the country are showing up for Haley. But, you know, everywhere else, it's, you know, certainly been a much stronger Trump performance.
Fox News Radio's political analyst Josh Krasshauer and Fox News Radio's Washington, D.C. correspondent Jared Halpern. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thanks, Jess.
Thanks, Jess.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Thursday, President Joe Biden delivers his State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress, and Fox News Radio has complete coverage. Just click listen on the Fox News app starting at 8 p.m. Eastern to hear it all. Go to foxnewsradio.com for more details.
This is Tommy Lahren with your Fox News commentary coming up.
It's the second trial in a first-of-its-kind case holding a school shooter's parents criminally responsible for their son's killing spree.
I am a really bad person. I have done terrible things that no one should ever do.
That was Ethan Crumbly back in December, before he was sentenced to life without parole, promising to become a better person in prison. He pleaded guilty to murdering four classmates at Oxford High School in Michigan, November 30th, 2021, and injuring seven other people.
Of anyone of a school or parents, they did not know and I did not tell them what I planned to do, so they are not at fault of what I've done.
But just because Ethan excused his parents, prosecutors have not. Jennifer Crumbly was the first to go on trial on four charges of involuntary manslaughter, accused of ignoring her son's mental illness, not getting the 15-year-old the help he needed and asked for.
Of course, I look back after this all happened, and I've asked myself if I would have done anything differently, and I wouldn't have.
And wait till you hear what she said next in her testimony. We'll play it later. Now, Jennifer Crumbly was convicted a month ago and faces up to 15 years in prison at sentencing in April. This week, Ethan's father, James Crumbly, is on trial on similar charges.
Well, the most troubling case, I think, was Jennifer Crumbly's case because she was largely convicted of being a bad mother.
Jonathan Turley is a George Washington University professor of law and a Fox News contributor.
There were indications that her son was disturbed, and that is certainly something that has generated a great deal of condemnation about how they responded to it. With the father, the trial is likely to be different in one major respect. James Crumbly is accused of purchasing the weapon that was used in this shooting, and that is more of a traditional type of action for this type of charge. You know, he's being accused of effectively facilitating, even if it's negligent or reckless, the shooting itself.
Now, supposedly that gun, Ethan really wanted it, and his father said okay, and they went on a Black Friday shopping trip and got the gun. And James Crumbly insists that he had hidden it away and put the ammunition in a different place. The issue becomes the storage of this firearm, correct?
What's a notable distinction from the earlier trial is that he is not accused of receiving worrisome texts from his son. Those messages went to the boy's mother. So this is going to focus almost entirely upon the fact that he purchased this gun really for his son and then failed to properly secure it. The question is whether he can be viewed as committing a criminal act for not going beyond what's required under state law, or taking insufficient efforts, even if he did try to secure the weapon.
When you, though, look at this case, he does face similar involuntary manslaughter charges. The parenting issue is going to be brought up again. He is mentioned. For instance, Ethan Crumbly, there is a journal entry that he wrote that he's going to cause the biggest school shooting in Michigan's history. I will kill everyone I see. I have fully mentally lost it after years of fighting my dark side. My parents won't listen to me about help or a therapist. I have zero help. He doesn't say his mother. He says parents.
Yes, and there is also indications that he was obviously aware of his son's problems. There was one communication from him asking whether his son had been given Xanax one night to avoid a meltdown. So he was clearly aware that this was a troubled kid. The question for many of us in looking at these two trials is where to draw this line. Unfortunately, there are millions of families who are dealing with loved ones with mental illness that is particularly prevalent today. It's certainly increased among the very young. Criminalizing these tragedies will not necessarily help in that. These parents often find that they have a system that doesn't offer much support. It can be very difficult to get children into supervised care or overnight treatment. There are very few beds available in many states. Many families like this one are not well off. They have limited funds. So where do you draw the line here? No one is questioning whether these parents were aware of their child's mental problems. It comes down to what is required criminally of parents. What can they be criminally held liable for not doing?
The people who were victimized by this crime, they see that on the day of the school shooting, November 30 in 2021, the Crumbleys are in the school the morning of. They are talking to officials, the guidance people, and people in the school, and they're shown disturbing drawings and disturbing writings that their son had. And in the end, they leave. Ethan stays in school. No one checks the backpack, the gun's inside, and he goes on the shooting spree. If you are victimized by this crime, you'll want the parents to be held accountable, wouldn't you?
Oh, I'm sure I would. If my child was lost in this, I would want retribution.
Would you want the school held accountable? I mean, they left him there. Nobody checked the backpack.
Well, the question is not how one would feel as a parent, but how we handle not just this, but future cases. There's no indication that the parents knew that their son was going to commit this type of act. What they knew is that they had a very unstable son, that he had made threats to others. Did they act appropriately? I don't think they did. I think that they were negligent as parents in what they did. But I'm still quite divided about using the criminal code for this purpose. This is not excusing these two parents. I don't think that they did what they could have done. But I think it's very easy to turn to the criminal code and say, well, because the shooting occurred, you should also be held responsible in terms of a criminal complaint. Now, keep in mind, there's also civil liability that can come. You know, parents can sue these parents for their role in failing to take action. I would be more comfortable with civil liability than I would criminal liability.
But just suing them doesn't, for some people, they think, no, there has to be more than that. Obviously, people believe that. The prosecutors believe that.
Yeah, I can understand that. And when I first read the account of what these parents done, I was very upset, like many parents. But I have to be honest. I think that despite the many times I've looked at these complaints and looked at what happened in the trial, I still don't know how the prosecutors are delineating the line between bad parenting and criminal conduct. And that's a very dangerous thing for parents with millions of families facing these traumatic situations.
Because this is a precedent-setting situation, correct?
It certainly is.
So let's go to this trial in another way. Once things get underway, there is a roadmap. Obviously, the prosecution succeeded in Jennifer Crumbley's case. Defense attorneys also have the same roadmap. They see how her side lost. They see how prosecutors won. Who benefits in trial number two from that roadmap, or is it equal?
I think the prosecutors benefit more only in this sense. I think that the first trial was the more difficult trial to make for prosecutors. This one has an actual act that facilitated the shooting.
The gun, right.
Absolutely. So this has a more traditional feel. It'll be much more difficult for the defense. The fact that the defense couldn't stick the landing on the first trial, it means that they're going to have an even harder time here.
Now back to Jennifer Crumbley. On the witness stand at her trial.
If you could change what happened, would you? Oh, absolutely. I wish he would have killed us instead.
Now, some have said she came across as cold in her testimony and in how she acted after the school shooting. James Crumbley, Ethan's dad, is said to have been much more emotional in the aftermath, crying in the back of a police cruiser, sobbing during an interview at the station. So, will he take the stand at his trial? Should he?
Well, I do think that in a case like this, you have to, as a defense counsel, resist the temptation to play it safe. Most defense counsel are heavily inclined to keeping their client off the stand. It minimizes the risk of serious injury being done through testimony. But that minimization of risk helps the attorney sometimes more than the client. You can't be blamed for something that didn't happen. In a case like this, I would very likely put my client on the stand. I think the jury needs to hear from him because he did take this action. He did secure the weapon. They need to know why. And he needs to speak directly at them, to look at them and speak to them as a father who found himself in a very difficult position, as someone that you might not agree with, but you can understand why he was trying to develop these connections with his son. That may not succeed, but in my view, it may hold the only hope that he has.
In the end, what is the best ground for appeal? She's already been convicted. Maybe he will be. What's the best grounds for appeal?
I think that frankly, he has fewer grounds to appeal than his wife because of the action that he took. But in some ways, the appeals will be similar. The degree into which you're criminalizing bad parenting, he will focus on the fact that the prosecutors are assigning a certain recklessness or negligence to how he secured the guns, but that he did so in compliance with state law. The question is, can you be required to do even more? The answer to that is probably yes. I mean, even if the state law says you have to do A, B, and C, many jurors will feel that if you've got a troubled child in the house, you probably should do, E, F, and G. I mean, that you need to go beyond that, given what you're looking at. You can't just do the bare minimum.
Jonathan Turley, George Washington University professor of law, Fox News contributor. Very interesting case. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Benjamin Hall, Fox News correspondent and New York Times bestselling author. Join me for my brand new podcast, Searching for Heroes. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Tommy Lahren.
What's on your mind?
DEI, or Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion guidelines, have been a woke tumor on businesses and culture. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis had enough and put a stop to it in his state. At the start of the year, the Florida Board of Governors passed a regulation to limit public funding of DEI programs, and now those chickens are coming home to roost. Last week, the University of Florida eliminated all employees holding DEI-specific positions. Those employees are reported 13 full-time in DEI positions, and 15 involved in administrative appointments were cut and encouraged to apply elsewhere in the institution. Governor DeSantis celebrated this necessary step, saying, "Florida is where DEI goes to die." Governor DeSantis has once again proved that the things that other Republican leaders simply just talk about, he does, and he does with stunning accuracy. He is the future of the GOP. Well, that is, if we're smart, at least. I'm Tommy Lahren, and you can watch my show, Tommy Lahren is Fearless at Outkick.com.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.